Okay. So we did some meditation. That was nice. So Devin and I we're gonna say some things. And I'm gonna start off, and then I'll hand it off to Devin. Maybe she'll hand it back. We'll see how it all goes, but maybe we'll talk for 20 or 30 minutes here. And we thought maybe it'd be nice to, the path has a kind of arc, maybe. So we thought maybe it'd be interesting to talk about that arc of the path and how we come on to the path and what it means to be on the path, and at least for us. So we both started meditating pretty young. I won't tell Devin's story, maybe she can, but she was 19, 20 years old when she really got interested deep into this whole project. And I was maybe 15, 16, so like, no, it's probably 16. I think that's better to say. So there's this one moment, and there were many, many moments, but this one moment has become very meaningful looking back on it. So one moment was right after I got my driver's license. A big deal. I was living in a household that was not peaceful. Lot of problems, alcoholism and mental health issues and family stuff and parents who were struggling, really struggling. So when I got my driver's license, it was especially a big deal for me because I could leave the house. And I had a little Hyundai hatchback, two-door hatchback with it was a stick shift with four speeds and bright baby blue. And I loved this car. So I would take it, and I was already really, I would say in some ways I was already on the path. I didn't know it. I didn't know what I was doing, but I would take my car, and I was social. I had a lot of friends. I was playing a lot of music. I was a musician, like in bands and things like that. I was like my guitar and writing songs, and but I would take my car, and my favorite thing to do was to just go and be by the river. I was in the Hudson River Valley, and I would drive my car, and I would look at the Hudson River. And there was one day I did this at sunset. So, I drove away from my house and went about 15 minutes away to the Hudson River. It was a place called Rockwood Park, set aside by the wealthy Rockefellers for the little people. And as a little person, I was there, and I was looking at the river. It was sunset. It was spring. It was warm. It was beautiful. I think there were swallows or something. These birds that were sort of diving around. They're so pretty, and the sun was setting, so it was red across the water, and it was like rippling red sunset water. And I was looking at the beauty, and I had this moment of extremely precise recognition that I was looking at the beauty, but it was not touching me. It was like there was this wall of plexiglass between me and everything. And I had this feeling of it was rigid, frozen, And I had thought, this is beautiful. This is a beautiful moment, but not for me. You know, it's not beautiful. I'm not touched by it somehow. And I thought, this is not right. You know, there has to be more to life than feeling constantly disconnected, frozen, and anxious, scared, you know, cut off. And I didn't really know what to do with that except smoke weed and play really loud music. That seemed to help for a while. And but even that kind of freaked me out because my parents were addicted to substances. So I never went too far in that direction. It didn't seem like a real solution. So I was looking, you know, I was looking for what is the solution? If this is, you know, drugs is not going to work for me because I'm watching these other people, it doesn't work for them. And then into that sense of being troubled by my own, what I would call dukkha now, you know, this dissatisfactoriness, there dropped a book into my life called Insight Meditation by a guy named Joseph Goldstein. And it's funny, it's not a really exciting book, you know, in some ways, like for a teenager, like for a 16-year-old. But for me, it explained everything. Because in that book, what Joseph does is he talks about dukkha, you know? He talks about the unsatisfactoriness of existence. He talks about this contraction and the sense of being, yes, separate from. And then he says, this is like part of the human condition. But unlike the existentialists that I was reading, he then says, and there's a way through this. And there's a path. There's a path that goes from here to the end of suffering. And that path is a path of meditation. And then he gives you all these meditations that you can do. And so there I was, 16 years old, alone in my room, in our house, in the suburbs of New York City. And I like took the pillows off my bed, threw them on the ground, and crossed my legs and started meditating. And it was totally impossible. And there were no meditation apps, and I didn't know of any meditation groups. And there, so I just sat there a couple weeks, like every day, dedicated, like, okay, I'm gonna do this. And after 3 or 4 minutes, I would get up totally frustrated. Like, this is not, it was weird. Even right from the start, I had faith that it would work, but I couldn't access it. And through a long series of events, I found a teacher. And then I went up to a weekend retreat in this tiny little meditation center in the upstate New York in Derry country. And during that first weekend retreat, I had my first moment. I mean, most of the retreat was me realizing that I was insane, you know, like, oh my God, I cannot control my mind. And there was actually a lot of disturbing images and, you know, like a lot of violent images and anger for me personally, and then contraction and fear and disgust at myself. And but then there is this moment of the plexiglass evaporated, you know? So one moment of just feeling touched by the world, which was enough. That was confirmation for me of like, okay, this is it. And so then I was working with this meditation teacher for some years, and I went back and I just started to work. And I would say what was happening for me, you know, there's a lot of, in Buddhism and the Dharma, there's a lot of cognitive pieces that are very, very helpful. You know, you learn the Four Noble Truths, you learn the Eightfold Path, you learn the Three Marks of Existence. There's a kind of a cognitive inoculation process, where you start to recognize the way things are, and you're therefore not as disturbed by the way things are, and you acclimate to the way things are. And there's a lot of that cognitive that's very, very helpful. But more fundamentally, I think what was happening for me was that my nervous system, which was really out of whack, and I think this happened a little more quickly for me because I was young and still flexible, my nervous system started to resonate with my teacher. And his nervous system was more settled than mine, more clear than mine, more flexible in a way than mine. And so, you know, like, as I meditated, I went up on a bunch of weekend retreats. And then, you know, when I was 18, I did a month-long retreat with him. Then I took time off college. I did a five-month retreat with him, and then did a bunch of 2 months retreats with him. And gradually, there was this process of, I would say that the nervous system began to level out. And that's been the process for me over years and years now. Not that it's always level. But the baseline changes, you know? Where I live most of the time, it's always up and down. I think this is just an important thing to normalize for everyone. Maybe when you're an arhat, it's no longer up and down. But I'm not that interested in that. I'm actually really interested in what's happening right now. And what's happening right now is there's up and down, and there's really this intensity of experience, but there's also this gradual process of connection, maintaining of connection and warmth, and almost like a sweetness that grows over time. As you know, you could also talk about it in terms of the subtle energy body, which we do a lot of in the Vajrayana, so-called Tibetan Buddhism. The nervous system begins to resonate like on a different electrical frequency somehow. Yeah. Maybe I'll hand it over to Devin. I bet she's got lots of good things to say.
Thank you. Yeah, so, you know, each of us have these paths. And I think in some ways, what Craig is talking about is like, we have a sense of things, like it could be our aspiration or what matters to us. And there's this kind of biological longing or biological yearning to find that. So for you, you might also have had that moment of like, when does the plexiglass dissolve? And we have these touch points of like, oh, and then, oh, okay, maybe it's this way. I remember being young and kind of having that same sense of like, what is it? Where is it? It's got to be somewhere. Like, is it God? You know, where do I find this? Is it in nature as the sacred? But when I first read my first book on meditation, I had this sense of like, oh yeah, this is it. So also young, like kind of hooked early. And then I kind of went full on, like, I want to be a nun, I want to be a monastic, like, how do I do this path fully? And because I was learning about the Vajrayana, there's a lot of stories about 3-year retreat and 10-year retreat, and the sense of if you're really going to realize the path, it has to be in these very particular circumstances. So from the very get-go, this was almost 20 years ago, I had this kind of sense of the conditions for a Dharma practice look like this. And often they involve leaving the world and really intense commitment and not a lot of sleep, some ascetic practices, that kind of thing. And I remember my first time in India, I was quite young on pilgrimage with a group, and it was like almost the first week we were there, third or fourth day, still jet lagged. We went to Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama lives, and we met with His Holiness Karmapa, who's the lineage holder for our Kagyu school. And he was 17 at the time. I was 21. And I was one of the very few young people in the group. There's a lot of older people. And because I was young and he was young, I got to ask the first question. And I remember just feeling so sincere and so heartfelt and this, like, all this devotion for him. And I sort of wanted to ask him, like, can I ordain? because I want to be a nun. I really want to do this practice. And everything I was reading and learning sounded like that's what I had to do. And there's this really beautiful moment where he looked at me and it felt like, and again, this might just be my own projection, but it felt like he was seeing right through me. Like he knew me, he was looking at me, he knew the importance of my question. And it was really sweet the way he has this kind of self, like the demeaning posture, like, I don't really know how to answer your question, but I think maybe it has something to do with just being mindful. You know, you don't have to be a nun or go off to some special place or do this unique, extraordinary thing. You can just be mindful all the time in your regular everyday life as a student, as a teacher, whatever you're doing, just be mindful all the time. And that will be practicing the path. And in some ways, that was a touch point for me. That was like, a relief and this feeling of really being seen. And in some ways, because I was just finishing college and kind of like looking for my way, that felt like, this is a compass for me. Like, I'm not going to be a monastic. I'm just going to do this mindfulness thing as much as I can, right in the stir of everyday life. And yet, it's interesting now, I'm still finding how this mind tends to bifurcate into binaries, like good practice, bad practice, long retreat, really good, being messy in the world, maybe kind of being lazy. So again and again, I keep meeting up against, I think they're actually internalized patterns of maybe misunderstanding the path or thinking that the path is somewhere out there. Like that's for all the men in Asia who get to do it in these circumstances, not really for me here in this body and mind. You know, or when Craig talks about going on these long retreats at a young age, like not all of us have that opportunity. So how do we actually do deep dharma, deep liberative practice in these conditions? And right now my edge is just as I'm learning about all the binaries in the world, politically, gender identities, to see how, this is just the mind trying to simplify, overly simplifying things. It's either this or that. And yet the way that things are, truly, I think the Dharma is much more of a continuum. There's a whole spectrum of truths. And it's all about holding paradox. So maybe it's about both and. It's about actually using our circumstances to wake up just as they are, not having to be any different than we are. You know, I love this teaching that the Buddha says he only teaches one thing, only one. And he says, I teach suffering and its end. And isn't that two? But nowadays I'm feeling like, that's a pointing out to this interesting relationship between the dual and the ultimate. Like maybe suffering and its end aren't different. You know, maybe the way I think I was saying this last night, like through. So it's quite hard to talk about this realm of paradox. And the mind wants to be like, all right. So it's about, it's so funny. I watch my mind want to like find an answer to this. Okay, so then it's everyday life practice. That's where it's at, right? We tend to want to tip one way or the other. So how do we hold both truths at once? The truth of relative reality that has all these isms and all these power hierarchies and all this mess, that's true. And also the truth of the ultimate that is co-arising and interdependent with the relative. So in ultimate truth, it's all emptiness. And yet that's not separate from the relative, from the being very human, from this aliveness, this nervous system that we're experiencing. So how do we live with the emptiness infused in the relative? This is my practice really every day, waking up with a bad mood and trying to see, this is also Dharma. And watching how the mind uses practice to try to bypass or repress or escape. And then being like, no, it's turning towards, this is the Dharma right here in all of this, the reactivity, the messy mind. And then also the moments of clarity, both and. So I've been reading little passages and stuff to share with you today. This is one of my favorite books lately. It's called The Inner Work of Racial Justice by Rhonda McGee. And I think I'm also talking a little bit about how the personal becomes political here. So we're never doing this in a vacuum. We can't separate out Dharma from politics anymore, I don't think. It's another one of those binaries. So this is Audre Lorde. Refusing to recognize difference makes it impossible to see the different problems and pitfalls facing us. And true, unless one lives and loves in the trenches, it is difficult to remember that the war against dehumanization is ceaseless. So the war against dehumanization, I kind of think that is samsara. That's dukkha, right? The mind that always wants to separate and feel divided and alone and isolated. So yeah, dukkha is ceaseless. That's the first noble truth, unreliability. But when we recognize that and we're willing to live and love in the trenches, right in the spin of it, right in everything feeling decentered and off its axis and all of it, social media and these really activating politicians, right in all that reactivity, that's when we start to see, oh, maybe there's a way through this. You know, we did this practice on our heroes and heroines and role models, and those people have, for me, my people have had, man, such deep difficulties in their lives. His Holiness Dalai Lama, who lost his country. And, oh my goodness, just so many others. Gandhi and all these folks in South Africa who were part of the Truth and Reconciliation Council. You know, it's like in being willing to really be in the trenches. That's the work. And, you know, it's always different for each of us. But this, for me, I think I notice my mind wanting to check out and sort of rely on my privilege of comfort. And yet, can I remember, no, it's actually in facing towards and engaging that I can actually grow that muscle of strength that knows justice, that knows freedom right in there, and knows that it's collective, that we're all doing this together in our own belonging, our mutual belonging. So the old original topic for today was see the good. And in some ways, that's also assuming a kind of binary. But maybe what we're talking about or what I'm leaning into is like, there's a kind of courage and bravery that is right there in the bad, in what feels bad, in the defilements even. Can we still have a strong heart, a resilience that sort of refuses to be overcome or, like Craig was saying, disconnected from the body? That's like, nope, right here in it, I'm going to find my own ground. You know, like the Buddha touching the earth in the face of self-doubt. Like, this is my place. Right here in this body. Right here in this world, in this culture, in this country. Right here. Talking about it inspires me, but it's also the sense of, whew, that's a high bar that we have to meet. You know, there's this Zen koan that's about a farmer, these two farmers that are sort of asking each other questions about emptiness. Like this big Dharma debate. And their movement is like, at one point, Seisan, you might remember this better, but there's something about this farmer planting his hoe. And that image of planting the hoe is so strong for me. It's like that touching the earth mudra, but like, I'm just going to plant my hoe right here, right in this life. And then just do as much as I can with all my heart, with all the while a sense of letting go. Yeah. Do you remember the details of that koan, Love? Do you want to describe it?
Sure. Yeah, so it's actually, it's a teacher and a student. The student's name is Yao Shan. And names don't really matter for this moment. So yeah, and in China, they're always farming. And practice was very integrated with daily life. Chop wood, carry water, do the work, and do it as an enlightened body, fully awake body. So student comes up to the teacher and the teacher says to him, where are you coming from? And Yaoshan's carrying his hoe. And he says, I'm from the fields. And the teacher says, how many people are there in the fields? And then Yaoshan plants his hoe. And the teacher says, are there none? And then Yaoshan lifts his hoe and walks off. Which makes absolutely no sense if you're not studying Zen. But it actually is extremely poignant to the conversation we're having right now, because it's both stillness and activity. It's the planting your hoe is this firmness and samadhi of being right here and not getting caught up in the details of life, like how many people are in the field. But then picking up the hoe and going is engagement. And so we're continually moving back and forth between these polarities of planting the hoe, finding our strength, being fully here, and picking up the hoe and walking, movement, activity, and engagement. That's all I got. Back to you.
That might be a good kind of wrap up. Zen koans are so good for that, right? They leave you with this kind of like, okay.